Doom Patrol buries their straights, and I am here for it.
This is a super hetero couple, and you're like, that bitch.
See? See what you get for being straight?
Okay, so the two episodes that we're going to be going over today is Flex Patrol and Penultimate Patrol. So leading into the Flex Patrol, we have the previously on Doom Patrol. We find our heroes department that goes after oddities and tries to normalize them or like get rid of them in an effort to make everything normal. And it's very much a parallel with the way that conservatives like to go ahead and, you know, get rid of like anybody who has a dissenting opinion, because the normal thing is heterosexuality and, you know, not having meta human powers.
It's interesting because, okay, so when I worked more in depth with disabled populations who are vulnerable and maybe necessarily don't have the perspective of how they're viewed from the outside, I've got these two convergences, okay? So you might call it old school, where I have this part of my brain that goes normalize, 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 right? So you try to make it So you try to make somebody's integration into more neurotypical society or physically typical, physiotypical society, like you try to make that as normal, swish, swish as possible. But that, from the other perspective, is ableist, and it denies the person autonomy of being able to identify how they interact with their own brain and body. And so, like, I see it from both sides, and it's interesting to put it in perspective of this show, because there are certain disabilities that have like an aspect that can be perceived as a superpower, right? Well, if you've got some kind of savantism, right? You have a super specialized intelligence and hyperfocus in this one area. You know everything, right? But then you turn around and that person might not recognize things that other people find vulgar in, I almost said polite society, but I mean just in general public, right? They don't understand a certain level of like what might be normalized dignity, right? So like, okay, you know everything about every baseball game that has happened in the last 200 years, right? But also you stick your hand into your pants to like scratch your ass. And so like, how do you guide someone to have normal polite behavior without denying them the thing that makes them special and the thing that, you know, inspires them and interests them? All of them are just, okay, so when you say the Bureau of Neuroanalysis, I'm like, okay, yeah, those are obviously the bad guys, mm-hmm. right? I get it.
Yeah.
But also, you can't have somebody with laser beam eyes out there frying kids at the playground.
Right. I just think that there's a more humane way of, you know, dealing with people who have laser eyes, a la, you know, Professor X in X-Men, where he's like, no, we can use technology to make sure that that is blocked off, and or we can, you know, try and help you with like figuring out your powers.
Yeah, because it equally makes, for Cyclops specifically, it makes him equally impressive and miserable.
Right.
And he fixed it with glasses.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, like, oh, it's so complicated. It's so sticky. Oh, yeah. There's no way to get in there cleanly and get out cleanly. There's no way. And I think this series speaks to that really well.
Right. And the Bureau of Normalcy will go ahead and take what are called metahumans and put them into what's called the ant farm. And they're not just like taking them so they're away from society. They also use them as a way of helping the United States government.
They weaponize them.
Cyborg was essentially kidnapped by the Bureau of Normalcy, and that's why the Doom Patrol were in there trying to rescue him. But while he was in there, he was starting to hear Mr. Nobody's voice in his head, and he was starting to believe his father was actually this bad guy. And he was like, eh, it's a little bit sus.
it might be a little bit true.
Yeah. But as a result of kind of feeding into Mr. Nobody, he, you know, attacked his father to the point where his father is like beaten and, you know, unconscious, but he's still alive.
Yeah, he thought he killed him.
Yeah.
But then Rita steps in. Well, that happens in a little bit, right? Because, okay, so Flex Patrol opens up on a near sepia toned. Are we starting now? or starting the actual synopsis.
Well, I just wanted to mention that Vic Stone's father is Silas Stone, who is played by Phil Morris. And Silas Stone is like the owner of this very like big company that deals with technology. And so Silas Stone is like very intelligent, very smart. And even Vic's mom was like a doctor in her own way. And she was just about as smart. But Vic has always kind of had a contentious relationship building up to this moment, to this episode. Vic's relationship with his father has always been like, I feel like Vic is like feeling controlled by his father. And so Vic's whole thing is like, I'm a superhero, but I need to be a superhero on my own terms, not the terms of what my father wants me to be.
In other episodes, when you do meet Vic's mom, she seems to have more emotional intelligence than his dad has. So I think he's missing that. He's missing that guidance. You know, when I, regardless of their gender, having two parents being able to show you maybe a more analytical view and then a more humanistic, natural way of like flowing through. Like you get that when you have like a duality guiding you. Not that you can't have that as a single parent or, you know, whatever. You can't have that growth independently as a human who's growing. But like, I think for his particular character, he's missing that kind of warmth that his father doesn't have, that his mom kind of shows that she has.
Right. In a flashback, we see that Vic had broke his arm. And the reason why was because of something that his father told him not to do. And when his mom takes him to the doctor, she's just like, we're not going to worry about telling your dad about this because it's not something that's really going to, it's like, what is it? It's not something that is going to really help the situation. And it's just going to aggravate him more. And it's just, you know, going to kind of bring out the like, I told you so, son mentality that his dad kind of has.
For sure. But at this stage of his character development, I would say that his dad is a stone cold jerk. And I will 0.5 him because I think he kind of might be a good guy. Maybe, maybe.
Right. You can see he has the best intentions with his son, but he still is kind of like overprotective and a bit of like, he's very, you know, like you have to do it this way and my way is the best way because I'm the adult and you're the kid. And you know, that moment where the adult in your life still kind of regards you as a child and you're like, I'm in my mid-30s.
Yeah. I mean, I have very distinct memories where I went from, oh, you're this omnipotent. Nah, I never thought of my parents as God, but like you are this authority who knows all, right? I have distinct memories where I went, oh, you don't know what's going on right now.
Right.
Or you're vastly misinterpreting the situation, you know?
Right.
It's an interesting developmental thing.
Mm-hmm. And it happens to everybody. And this is why, like, Vic is the youngest out of all of them. And so he has this, like, the character growth that he has is, like, it's just about as interesting as all of the other character development, and it makes sense for how old he is and what he's kind of come through. I mean, it was like, I get the impression that as an older teenager, like towards the end of his high school years, he caused this accident that essentially got his mom killed, and he holds that as like the reason, like, I can't mess up again, because if I do, someone could die. And so he's very like stern. He's like, in the earlier episodes, he's a lot like his dad in that, like, you just need to do what I tell you to do because I'm the one with the more experience.
Yeah, but when you think about people with cataclysmic thinking, hi, how are you? My name is Naomi. I have cataclysmic thinking. One of the facets of OCD, which I do not have, I believe, but I'm very familiar with, is if you don't do this, people will die. And to base all of your decisions on that type of thinking is unreasonable. But when you're in that type of thinking, it makes all the sense in the world, right?
Right. And speaking back to Victor, when he was in that moment with his dad, having that kind of thinking and holding that kind of thinking as being the best thing to do, it doesn't give you a lot of wiggle room for your emotions. And so for Victor, he couldn't process the fact that his father was, I mean, he was manipulated to this huge extreme for his father being this like villain in his life by Mr. Nobody. But his reaction to it wasn't just, I need to pick up and I need to walk away. His reaction was, I need to hurt my father. That's what he's grappling with at the beginning of this episode. So Flex Patrol actually starts out with a flashback.
Yes.
In Great Bend, Kansas in 1964.
So this guy in leopard print pants is walking hand in hand with this dandy little lady in like this near bopper skirt. What would they call them? Those like she's got petticoats on or whatever. And they're like just walking to a picnic and they're just all smiles.
Yeah, it's an idyllic Midwestern town with an idyllic, you know, idyllic Midwestern town complete with superhero in loving relationship. And, you know, they're...
Who loves him for his smile, not just his strength.
Yeah, they're a little bit like gag me because they feel so far from real.
Yeah, they're saccharine. They're idealized. It is too much. But also... They lull you in with this because they walk over and sit on the, like, he like uses his flex to put out the blanket and she sits down.
They have a picnic and
he flexes food into existence and flexes a tulip.
Oh, also that lunch looked just like super basic and it was like, I wrote a note in it. That is one sad looking lunch. It's just like an apple and a cookie and a sandwich with white bread and
like a glass of milk or something like
yeah.
that.
Yeah. I mean, this is like 1960s. Just
it was,
like
a gingham blanket and everything. It was just this scene.
It was like it's something to kind of bring back, like, you know, when people start talking about that height of American culture and this was the best time, you know, those kind of like older generation type people saying that was back when America was great.
Yeah, and I'm
like,
for you. Hey, for you. And with the rosy colored glasses of retrospect.
Mm-hmm.
But so they sit down and she tells him his smile is his greatest flex.
And he says that she has the best laugh. And you know, he loves her laugh.
And she's the light of his life or whatever. But then they hear crying and she's like, oh, you better go save him. And she's staring at her tulip.
Yeah, because when he flexes the tulip, there's this camera angle where it's next to her face and his butt is right next to her face.
That's pretty good.
It is pretty good.
But he walks over to this kid who's got this blank kind of face, which I think is interesting. And he's like, my cat's in the tree. And he's like, he flexes his bicep and the tree comes down and he very cutely picks up the cat and then it's just like, well, here you go. After like he doesn't. He holds up the cat and he's like, oh, my cute little guy. And the cat's like, laser face.
Yeah.
Which is startling because you've spent the last probably 2-3 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
In this beautiful, laser cats don't exist in this world.
No, well, I mean, they shouldn't, but in a world with someone who can flex things into existence.
In a world where a cat can suck your face into another, can teleport you somewhere else.
You know, that reminds me of those myths of, like, cats stealing the breaths of children.
Mostly untrue.
Well, yeah, because
they're cats. We said cat and it's just all, like, all up on the mics right now, stepping on the soundboard. You said cats. I thought it was my turn. You said that ever since cats, when you didn't let me participate anymore.
You didn't want to participate in cats.
We tried.
We tried. Go back to our cats episode.
I held her up to the microphone.
And she was like, I don't know. Come in on cue.
No, she's really not that guy. Anyways, laser cat.
Yeah, laser teleporting cat to present day. It goes back to present day and we have this rise up, prisoners, reclaim your freedom moment.
Oh, I call it the ant farm jailbreak.
Oh, yeah, that's it too.
But we've got Vic and his dad on the floor.
Mm-hmm.
Rita comes over, does a vitals check. He's alive, but we've got to get him out of here now.
Right. And then Cliff and Jane show up and Cliff super demandingly says, Jane, you got to get Flit out here so she can teleport us all out.
That's not how it works.
Yeah. And like Cliff is the only one who kind of demands this of Jane, like bring out your personalities so that way we can, you know, use them. And it's like, nope, that's not how it works.
I get it, but you're asking a trauma response to come out in an emergency on demand.
Right.
Mm.
Even if it's necessary, it's like, you can't be demanding that guy.
Yeah. They do have a long-haired prisoner wander out into the hallway.
Well, the long-haired prisoner he stays in there and then
negative spirit
comes out and he goes over to him. And
no, we're supposed to stay in our cells.
Yeah. And like, obviously there's an exchange going on between them, but we only hear this hairy guy's dialogue. And then the negative spirit grabs his remote and that's how he gets him out of his cell.
Yes. And Yeah, they all coalesce into this group, and Rita's like, "Oh, aren't you that guy from that comic?" And this kind of sort of unnecessary.
Like, I don't know how she could have figured it out.
I don't think he looks like the same guy. It takes me a few minutes into the episode to be like, "Oh, right, long hair changes how people look."
But Rita, she was also probably like around when this character was out and about, and like, I mean, knowing her history, she probably didn't have much to do outside of just read and read and read.
And the comic book that they were given by Danny the Streets, she had been like fixated on it because it was very important. Mm-hmm. So she had read it several times.
Right. And then Flit comes out at the last minute to help teleport them. And as they teleport, the guy who's chasing them, like
he does a lunge grab, doesn't he?
I think so. What I remember about him is he is like the big bad. He's like the guy who runs this whole thing. And when they teleport, he says, "Balls!" Which is hilarious because they were, where ass. Where butts.
with I don't think, any kind of other genitalia.
Yeah. So.
All right.
And then Flit teleports them back to their mansion.
He needs to get to a hospital.
Yeah. What is it? So the big thing here is Vic and his father need to get to a hospital. So Flit teleports them to the hospital. And then when Flit comes back and Jane's, talking to Rita, Rita's just like, "You can't just leave them alone," even though they're at a hospital. Like, Rita's like, "Vic is too emotionally unstable to go ahead and be left alone with his father." And so Flit teleports Rita over there.
She comes back and he's like, "Why did you do that?" Well, was it Robot Man who's like, "Why'd you do that?" And she's like, "Now she's not alone."
Yeah. Then Cliff like kind of brings up the fact that they rescued Cyborg, who was a legit superhero in this universe.
Yeah, he starts high-fiving himself, basically.
And he like and they got out of the ant farm. They made their escape, but they also got the hairy dude. The hairy dude, is Flex Mentallo, the guy that we had mentioned or we saw in the flashback. And so Cliff's just like, "Yeah, we did so good. We did so good." And Larry's just like, "I'm tired. I'm gonna go to bed."
Yeah. Yeah. Then do we cut to back to the ant farm, like a flashback?
Yeah. So Larry goes back up to his room and Negative Spirit comes out and he's just like, at this point, Larry and Negative Spirit have been separated because of the ant farm, and Negative Spirit is no longer tethered to Larry, but Larry needs the Negative Spirit in order to live.
Right.
And so when he goes up to his room, Negative Spirit's kind of following him. And he's like, "Look, you don't have to be around me anymore. You're, free to go. I'm really tired. I just, don't really want to have to deal with it." And then Negative Spirit like conks him out and has him go into a flashback.
Mm-hmm. Now we're back at the ant farm.
Right. 1964.
Mm-hmm. And they're like, the guy behind the glasses, like, we gotta test the spirit guy. And except it's not like spirit, it's like entity.
Yeah.
Or whatever. And
energy being.
So they're like, they threaten death for Trainer until the Neg comes out.
Right.
They threaten him. And so I think they do. Is this the part where they manipulate him into coming out?
I think what they do is they put on a frequency that's so loud that only the Negative Spirit can hear it. And he has like the splitting headache. And Larry doesn't really want this thing around, whatever it is. He's just like, go ahead, do whatever you want to it. And it's not really affecting Larry at all. But at this point, Larry is in this big old rubber suit with like a breathing apparatus. And it's really clunky for him to move around.
Yeah. Not that he's allowed to. He's strapped down everywhere he goes.
Almost everywhere. Not in his little room. But what they did is Larry. And at this point, Larry and the Negative Spirit are still tethered together. And so when they take Larry into his room, Negative Spirit goes in there as well. I think it was at this point before they take him back into the room that the Negative Spirit comes out, Larry faints, and then they threaten to shoot Larry, which the Negative Spirit is like, I don't want anybody to die for me.
Well, yeah, he's like, if he dies, what happens to you?
Oh, yeah, they think that the host, if the host is dead, then the Negative Spirit will die as well.
Yeah.
So
I don't know if that's true.
We don't know. They probably don't know. They're just testing out a theory.
But he does. He believes it enough that he goes back in there, and then they bring him back to his room, and he's like, ugh.
Right.
Now through a vent, a convenient vent.
Well, Flex hears something going off in the next room.
Mm-hmm.
And so he like flexes one of his muscles and it opens up this opening and everything. Yeah. And he's like, hey, guy, I thought I heard, are you doing okay? And he's just like, yeah, it wasn't me. It was, you know, the thing that was with me. Something like that.
Yeah.
Right. And
he doesn't really want to talk to Flex. And but then like the spirit pops out, which makes Trainer go down.
Right.
And then we this is our first interaction, our canonically first interaction where we learn that Flex can just understand Neg.
Yeah.
Where nobody else can.
Yeah. And again, we see that one-sided conversation where Flex is like, yeah, I can totally get you back home, but you got to get me out of here first.
You got to reach through and pull these wires out. Well, right. Apparently he can't do that.
Right. And so he goes back in, a negative spirit goes back into Larry, and Larry's just like, look, you can't. I think at this point, Larry has been in the ant farm for 3 years. And so he's just like, look, they're not going to let you out. There's no way of you escaping, and I can't do it. And Flex is still trying to be like, no, if Larry literally just reached in and pulled out some of the cords that were tampering Flex's powers, mm-hmm. he would have been able to get out.
Right. But that doesn't happen.
Because Larry is too afraid to get out there.
Well, that's kind of Larry's whole thing.
Yeah. Hit the nail right on the head. You saw that. Never mind.
I'm not the robot man. That's not the one I identify with the most. I might resemble him the most.
So that's yours. Who do you most think you're like, Lydia?
Out of the Doom Patrol?
There's the one you want to be like, and then there's the one that you're actually like. I'm probably a lot like Robot Man, but I want to be like Jane.
Yeah. I'm probably... I've always kind of identified with the Barbarians, so I'd probably have to say I identify most with Cliff, because he's just like so out there.
That's the one you want to be like?
No, that's the one that I want to be like Jane. But
we all do.
But I think I'm more like Cliff, because I'm not classy enough to be Rita.
I beg to differ. I feel like when I've seen your leadership present itself strongly in a good way, it resembles Rita just a little bit. Just the leadership, yeah. Like the, this is what we're going to do. And then you just like,
throw. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. But I still think I'm more like Cliff, because I'm kind of a bruiser. Like if I needed to go ahead and, you know, grab a watch down the throat of an alligator.
Okay.
I think I could. I don't think that I would be. I think I would be a little bit like, let's put the alligator down and then cut open.
Let me. Okay. Here's what I mean to say when I say that there's one that you identify with, yeah. And one you're like. I feel like there's one whose weakness you have and one whose strength you have.
Oh, okay.
So I think I have Cliff's weakness.
Okay.
But I think I want Jane's strength of being multifaceted and like powerful in a number of situations.
Mm-hmm.
So in that light, what do you think?
I would say, because Jane's biggest strength is like being able, just she's like kind of a Swiss Army knife,
yeah.
So to speak. But she doesn't like force her identities to come out just at the drop of a hat. You know, it's like she, you know, kind of has to, they have to be willing.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the strength that I would want, is kind of that Swiss Army tool of, you know, capabilities.
Yeah.
Honestly, as far as like my weaknesses go, I'm probably more like Larry. Like, no, let's just stay inside. We don't have to go out.
It's reasonable.
Like, no.
There's nothing wrong with it.
I mean, we're just going to hurt a lot of people if we go outside. We should just stay inside, Flex.
Worked for Elsa for like how long? How about you, Jen?
I think I have the weakness of Rita's insecurity. Like, if I'm anxious about something, I just kind of melt. I just am unusable in social gatherings if something just kind of sets me off. I think I have some positive qualities from maybe Cyborg. Just sort of the positive attitude towards solutions and feeling like there's a hopeful way out of things. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. You're right on that. We're all very self-aware.
Yay.
By no means idyllic, but we are there somewhere.
Right.
You would hope that these characters are relatable, that they're written to be, you know, somebody that somebody could identify with.
I mean, that's the whole point of the monster canon overall. Like, we've talked about it in other films like Night of the Living Dead and stuff, but like the power of a monster and the weakness of a monster, like the terror that it brings,
mm-hmm.
are like dualities of the average schmuck.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Good. So
let's cut back to the mansion now.
Yeah. We're with Cliff and Jane, and they're trying to help Harry Guy remember that he's Flex Mentallo. And it doesn't go anywhere.
At one point, he goes, whatever, scrap to Robot Man.
Yeah.
And he's like, I've got that scrap sticker on my head. And she's like, yep. And he's like, will you help me get it off? So she pulls this.
She pulls off one letter, and he's like, you just pulled off the S, didn't you?
And now his forehead says scrap, but he doesn't have like fingernails, so he can't get the sticker off his head.
Right, but Jane takes off the S, and he's just like, you just took off the S. And she's like, yeah. And so now
Flex is like, ha.
And he's just like, so now the sticker just says crap.
Yep. I thought that was clever.
It was. But Jane comes to the conclusion that maybe if they gave him a makeover,
yeah,
and got him looking like he used to, that might strike up his memories.
Like, showing him his ad didn't work. He's like, what a handsome young man. He has, like, no self-doubt on how attractive he is, which is fantastic. Scrap to crap. And then, yes. Robot Man and Jane start bickering, and then they mention Chief. And then he's like, I know all about Chief, and goes all about the plot line. And then Robot Man's like, oh, you know him? You know him? And then Jane's like, listens very closely. And she's like, you're talking about that crappy soap opera whose name I did not write down.
Sacred Hearts.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then it cuts away.
Right. This, everything with Cliff and Jane is kind of like, it does that thing where shows will cut back and forth between different groups of people. And that was like Cliff and Jane. And then it cuts back to Vic, Rita, and his dad in the hospital.
Yep. I call this, and every scene of it afterwards, mm-hmm. daddy drama.
Yeah. So the two biggest things that you need to know about this moment is, you know, Vic is standing next to his dad's bed, and he's blaming himself for the fact that he, you know, beat up his dad because of Mr. Nobody's manipulation.
My notes actually say daddy drama, blah, blah, blah. It's like the most least interesting part of the plot for me. Like, it's important, I suppose, but it appeals to me on no level.
We're
daddy drama town, right?
Daddy drama town. So, you know, while Victor is beating himself up and everything, Rita is encouraging him, which is different from their relationship at the start of the season, where it was kind of antagonistic. And then they kind of like come to a meeting of the minds, and they both, I like the dynamic between Rita and Vic throughout the entire show. I like the third season, not so much, but Rita was doing her own thing for the last season. But like in the second season, like, she wants to be a superhero, and Vic's like trying to be like, okay, so you want to be a superhero. So this is how you do it, basically, or sort of. He's a little bit encouraging.
Yeah, but there's no superhero 101, especially when your brain is still scrambled from all of this stuff.
Yeah. The other point that I wanted to mention is that Vic's software or operating system, so to speak, is called Grid. And
he's uninstalled it.
He has uninstalled it because he thought that Grid was going haywire and having a mind of its own, which kind of led him down this whole path of his dad, you know, kind of controlling him. And so he turned Grid offline. Mr. Nobody was able to manipulate him. And he believes that if Grid was turned on, Mr. Nobody wouldn't have been able to get in and, you know, manipulate him in the way that he was. So, but he needs to turn Grid back on in order to find someone who was looking for the Chief.
Well, yes. Rita had put a tracker on him, but she needs Jarvis to make that happen.
Yeah, Chris switching over to a different comic book company, but yeah.
It's the same thing.
Essentially. Jarvis, I think, has more personality. And then I think we go back to the makeover not working, and then, you know, going into Sacred Hearts and everything.
Yes.
But then we go back to...
I call that beauty school dropout.
Oh, yeah. But then we go back to Rita in the hospital eating all of these snowballs. She like has this large pile
while she's watching the news.
Right. And in the news, there's a report about a man by the name of Steve Larson, a.k.a. Animal Vegetable Mineral Man, who's played by Alec Mappa.
Yeah.
And he is this reoccurring character that comes through.
But only in the peripheral.
Only,
We never get a good old bite of the sandwich that is Animal Vegetable Mineral Man.
I disagree. I think we do get a nice bite. It's only a bite, but he first shows up in the second episode. No, it's the third episode when they're going to, you know, they're initially going to look for
the chief. Okay.
But I think they're also looking for the guy who kidnapped him, Mr. Nobody. And they know that, you know, if they go to Paraguay, they'll be able to find him. It's like this little like nugget of information that they have. And then when they go, they like are waiting at this bus stop, and there's Steve Larsen, just regular guy Steve Larsen, who's waiting there, and he's wanting to get, I think he's wanting to get magnetic feet so he can hang off the ceiling. Yeah. But he's just like, he's just really excited about it. And then later on, he doesn't get the powers that he had hoped for. Instead, he has like a melding of like rock. He's got a celery for an arm, and he has a second head, and it's a velociraptor.
An untrained, vicious
velociraptor.
Cretaceous lizard, yeah.
Right. And he's on the news because he, who, you know, idolized Eric Morden, wants to be a superhero, but he, or a supervillain, but he's pretty much in a, he's not effective. Like he goes, he gets, he's, his whole story arc is that he wants to be a supervillain, but he doesn't get the powers that he wants.
Uh-huh.
And then he goes to rob a bank, and he's completely an ineffective, you know, bank robber because he has this, this velociraptor who's untrained on his head. Then he gets caught by the police, and in order to like kind of strike a deal with the police, he's going to expose information that he knows that ultimately results in him having to go to court and mm-hmm. testify against the people who did this to him and give information. But when he does, he gets shot.
He was on the ground?
Yeah, he got shot by someone who says, "Von Fuchs is Uber. Von Fuchs is Uber."
What does that mean?
So the guy who does all of these experiments is a doctor by the name of Von Fuchs.
Yes.
And yes. All of his like devotees are like Nazis and everything.
Right.
Right.
We see him later. He's obsessed with marionettes, right?
Oh, yeah. In the third episode, when we see him, he is obsessed with marionettes.
I think that's pretty good.
Yeah. And that's a nice little like tidbit that makes the world feel bigger than just being just all about these characters.
Yeah. 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 I like how big the universe is in this.
Right.
Because when you're such a big character, like you can become entrenched. And we've all done it where we all like think we're the main character.
Yeah.
And then something happens and you're like, oh, yes,
I am the side character.
I might not even be a tertiary character here. That's cool.
Would you like to know some details of Animal Vegetable Mineral Man?
Yes.
His name is based on the lyric from the song Modern Major General. That's where.
I am the very model of a modern major general of information magnitude of animal and mineral. I know them zoological and quote them alphabetical. Yeah. Alphabetical. I am the very model of a modern major general.
Very good.
Is it close?
Sure, why not?
I'm just reading off some
okay.
details.
Okay.
He first appeared in Doom Patrol 89, which was in August 1964. Dr. Sven Larsen is a Swedish scientist and former student in the comics, a former student of Dr. Niles Calder. They had a falling out after Larsen accused Calder of stealing his idea for the anti-decay ray. And he does actually have the ability to form different parts of his body into an animal, vegetable, or mineral.
But he chose celery, a velociraptor, and a piece of rock.
We're in the initial inception of his powers, so he probably doesn't know how to make those changes yet. He's also in the Watchmen sequel, Doomsday Clock. He is listed as a member of a sanctioned superhero team called the Doomed in light of the Superman theory that started a metahuman arms race. And he's been in other television episodes as well, Batman the Brave and the Bold. And I think that might be the only other TV reference.
Lots and lots of references to this very obscure character.
He made a cameo in Teen Titans Go! The Comic, issue 28. The Doom Patrol discuss a battle they, along with younger Beast Boy, had with Animal Vegetable Mineral Man. He makes a full appearance on page 10, which itself is based on the cover of the Doom Patrol comic. That's it.
Fantastic.
Honestly, if this actor just constantly plays this one character throughout DC information or DC, you know, shows and properties, I would just absolutely love it.
100%.
Yeah.
The most unbelievable thing in this whole scene is that she wants to eat a pile of snowballs. That shit is nasty. I've never seen either of you eat one voluntarily.
I would never eat a snowball.
Coconut as candy?
Yeah.
Coconut, desiccated coconut on marshmallow on super dry chocolate, swish, swish chocolate cake. And then you have to wade through those three terrible layers to get to the cream filling?
Mm-hmm.
No thanks.
Yeah.
You wish you were a Twinkie. Get back on the boat.
Maybe that was the only thing that she had access to. And she was like, yeah, I'll do it. Because she's just ravenous at that point. But that's not the important thing about this scene.
Oh.
The important thing about this scene is that the news broadcast is interrupted by a crying baby. And Rita, like, turns to see this crib. And there's this really nice shot of the crib in between these murals of nurses that are facing towards the crib.
Of the era. Of her
of
era.
Of her era, yeah. And it freaks her. And then, you know, the mom comes by and picks up the baby.
Yeah, but not before her face melts.
Right. And she's like, I got to make an escape. And as she's escaping, she goes to the elevator, and who shows up but random old man played by Ed Asner. This is such a weird moment.
He doesn't even get a name, but that doesn't matter.
I have some additional information about Ed Asner. He's no stranger to DC. He also voiced Roland Daggett on Batman the Animated Series, Granny Goodness on Superman the Animated Series, Justice League Unlimited, and Superman Batman Apocalypse. Kent Nelson on Young Justice, and Perry White, Superman's boss, in All-Star Superman.
Go Ed.
Also, he's the guy from Up.
Yeah.
Is he?
Yeah, he's the old guy from Up.
Oh, God rest him.
Yeah. And then we cut back to Flex watching Sacred Hearts and Cliff and Jane talking about the fact that, you know, nothing's really working. I wanted to point out that Sacred Hearts is a soap opera that Flex has been watching over the last few years as he, you know, wastes away in the ant farm. And so he is there in the mansion watching the soap opera. And this is the dialogue that we hear on the soap
from
opera.
From the soap opera?
From the soap opera.
Yes.
This is a man speaking, by the way.
A doctor, right?
This is a doctor speaking. And I don't care that you ran off and married that Japanese sex robot. The Takumi 3000 will never love you the way that I love you. I don't know why. It was just like,
I heard the sex robot part and I was like, that's probably very interesting.
I also thought it was interesting that, you know, one of the metahumans that's helping him right now is a robot.
Fantastic. And he can't have sex, which is a thing that he hates. Jane's like, oh, no, it's Cliff who's just like, this is terrible. No, he's like, is this as bad? As when he guest starred on it, he's like, I remember it so much better. And Jane's like, this is terrible.
Right.
But Cliff gets in the way and
right. Making Flex see himself didn't jog his memory. And so Jane's thinking, well, you saw how frustrated he got when you interrupted his show, maybe, you know, you should go over there and, you know, like, you know,
don't let up.
And maybe he'll get so angry that he'll, you know, even if he doesn't jog his memories, we at least know what he does. And so Cliff goes over there. And he's, you know, bugging him and he's getting Flex, you know, worked up. And then he goes over to the TV and he just smashes it down.
He punches it into the screen.
Oh,
he like
yeah.
perfect circles his own fist in there. And Flex is like, and Jane's like, yes, yes, yes. And Cliff is standing there like ready to fight. Like
yeah.
he's got his dukes up.
Yeah.
And then Flex is like,
Okay, I like how they're turning Flex Mentallo from like this big beefy, like, you know, like it would be so easy for us to see this character be like kind of toxic in his masculinity.
Uh-huh.
Two random words I just decided to throw together.
Oh, wow.
In the same
did you come up with that?
Yeah.
You can probably write a paper.
But Flex, time and time again, proves that he's very sensitive. He, you know, he hurts people who are trying to get him to do something. Like in one of the flashbacks, we see him, like we see the people in the ant farm coming to get him, and one of the soldiers who is like trying to get him to, you know, get him out of the restraints and everything to get him to, you know, fight for the US, he just flexes a little bit and the guy gets thrown back.
Yeah.
And he's like, you know, I'm gonna go ahead and hurt people who are going to, you know, force me, who are going to kidnap me from my idyllic Midwestern life and you know, put me into a place where they're gonna try and use me as a weapon. I'm gonna see that as a justifiable concern. But like when Cliff stops him from seeing his show, which is a soap opera, by the way, he's like, no, I'm just going to cry about it.
I think he's in touch with himself to know when someone is causing him actual harm and when he's just upset.
Yeah, or when someone, you know, does something that isn't necessarily violent towards him or isn't going to cause violence towards another living being.
Yeah. People be missing shows. That's what happens.
Right. And then we cut back to Rita with this random old guy.
Yeah, he asks for help back to his room, but he doesn't know what room he's in. And so they end up sitting next to each other. And now they're just kind of talking.
Right. And he says that, you know, there isn't anybody in my life, but I kind of walked out on him first. So, you know, maybe they're the nice ones and I'm the asshole. And she's just like, well, that's not as bad as some of the things that I've done. And then she goes into her backstory.
Yeah, this chick, he's old, she's older. She like really just lays it out there that she, in her pursuit to become famous, falls in with a guy who wanted to take advantage of her, but instead she pivots and brings him vulnerable women who gain fame and success, and she continues to gain fame or at least have work to do in Hollywood, but he's obviously taking sexual advantage.
Right. And like it leads to such a degree that there's a
young woman becomes pregnant.
Yes. And she doesn't really know what to do. She didn't, this young woman, and this, you know, Hollywood producer isn't going to do anything. And the woman doesn't really have anybody around. And so Rita just kind of, you know, gives her, you know, some money and sends her on her way.
Yeah, she gives her abortion money and sends her away. And then there's a headline about the woman being dead and she feels terrible. The baby is never mentioned in the article as if it never existed, which is why the baby's a trigger for her.
Mm-hmm.
And she's just crying. And it's like this beautifully delivered speech. There's no flashback. It is just the most heartrending thing, except that you find out that she kind of pimped ladies.
Right. And, you know, it's this whole story of like, if you have no power in the industry that you work in and someone goes ahead and offers you the ability to have a little bit of power, would you take it? And I'd like to think that I wouldn't, you know, go ahead and do that. I have like, I'd like to think so. But she's also like an old time Hollywood actress.
She knows that there's stuff you have to do to be successful in the industry. And her speech concludes with her being like, and then the phone rang. And so she threw herself into her work.
She was about to go ahead and take responsibility for the child. And then the phone rang and she got the lead part, something that she has been working for this entire time.
And it's to the something of the lagoon.
Right. And it was the picture where she actually got her deformity. And she also mentions that doing the worst thing should be a lot harder than it actually is. And she kind of blames everything that happened on the fact that she was willing to just kind of let this child be thrown away like it didn't actually exist and have this woman's death, this woman's suicide, you know, be acted like it wasn't. Because like you talk about her pimping these women out, but how many of those were actually sexual assaults?
We don't know. And that's the thing. Lots of women coming into Hollywood, especially during this era, just knew that they had to take sex they didn't want on the chin to get ahead.
Mm-hmm.
And she's like, I understand that. These starlets understand that. Let's do this.
Mm-hmm.
And when somebody became desperate because she was obviously naive.
Maybe she didn't realize that that's what it was.
Mm-hmm.
And when she had a baby and she was like, you know, that was like, maybe she was also the woman who wanted to, you know, have a baby, but she didn't have any real. Obviously, she wasn't.
Was she pregnant or did she have the baby?
It sounds like from the monologue that the baby, you know, the baby was born. The studio producer wasn't going to step up and be the father. And when Rita gave her the money, maybe it wasn't abortion money.
No, I guess it was get on your way money.
Yeah, it was like, get away from me. You know, you served your purpose. Now here's some money and go away. That's the feeling that I got, like the baby was still there. And then the woman probably suffering from postpartum depression.
And depression because everything sucks.
Yeah.
And everyone's awful.
And it's also a time when if you have a child out of wedlock, you're seen as being, you know, this whore. And yeah.
You don't even have the dignity of being a sex worker. You are just unworthy of anything. You're this dirty thing.
You are literally tossed into the gutter. And she probably didn't have anybody because her family, you know, kicked her to the curb, whether it was before she went to Hollywood or after she went to Hollywood. And Rita like feels that at the end of her monologue. And she's like, everything that bad that happened to me was my own doing and I deserve it. But there's still sort of this, like, she's like, you know what, I'm going to, you know, get off my pity party. I'm going to, you know, like, stop feeling sad about myself.
Well, she says that she's never going to get atonement. There's no making up for what she's done. So the only thing she can do is
move forward
and be good, mm-hmm. as good as she can.
Yeah.
And I think that's a fantastic thing. And Ed Asner, character unnamed, goes, I think you got your power back, mm-hmm. or whatever.
Right.
It feels weird. It lands weird.
Well,
I think it's supposed to.
Yeah, it's supposed to, because as she walks away, we see, we don't see that just yet.
No,
we cut back to a flashback at the ant farm.
Yeah, I call this Sparky prison break wife torture.
Yeah. And so Flex is, again, Larry is getting thrown back into his cell next to Flex. And Flex is like, you got to just reach through here and you got to like pull out all these wires. And then we find out that Larry's like, no, I can't, because if I get out here, I'm going to radiate and I'm going to kill people. And I don't want that. And Flex is like, you know, the 2 out of 3 people in this group are like, you know, certain that we can get out and we can make an escape and everything, and we just need your cooperation, Larry. And Larry, being the linchpin in this, says no, because he is afraid of the fact that he could hurt people. And I think it's a little bit legitimate, but it still doesn't mean that he shouldn't, you know, take the chance.
Like, I feel like he was on the verge of turning, but that's when there's a noise at his door, at Flex's door, so he has to close the gap really quick.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it was just about to happen.
I think if Flex was given a lot more time, he could have gotten Larry on board.
Yeah.
But when the knock happens, they wheeled in this television, and
I immediately thought it was going to be the soap opera.
Mm-hmm.
They had queued it up so many times. I was like, oh, okay, soap opera time.
Yeah, and I thought it was like going to be some kind of mind control thing.
It was, kind of.
Kind of, but like when they bring it in, they turn it on, and that's when Flex sees his wife on the television. And one of the guys, you know, comes and grabs her hair, and he starts lighting it on fire. And so she starts crying and she's worried, and Flex is eventually just kind of recants and is just like, okay, fine, you can go ahead and do what you need to do if it means leaving my wife alone. But they don't really leave his wife alone.
Spoilers.
Oh, sorry. Spoilers for everything we do.
Sorry, this thing that's been out for over a year.
Right. Also, the guy who turns on the television is just sort of like, and maybe you can tune in next week to see how she's doing. And it's kind of like this whole, like, you know, he obviously getting into the soap opera,
mm-hmm.
is like, it, this is what starts with that.
Yeah, well, they have to make him forget himself, so that in making him forget himself, he forgets his power, and he also forgets his wife. So I'm sure at some point they had to transition him from them, like, manipulating him with his wife to, no, this is your soap opera time.
Yeah.
Number 7-2-2.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It also, I wanted to say that this point mimics a moment in episode 3 where we see the Doom Patrol coming back from Paraguay, where they killed the Nazi puppet guy.
Mm-hmm.
And Jane fogs up a window and writes, control is a weapon for fascists. So what they're doing to Flex right now is a method of control, because he wouldn't willingly consent to it. And they're trying to, and it's essentially, they're weaponizing his love for his wife. Control him.
It's very 1984.
Yeah.
It is very pre-Cold War era bullshit. Yeah.
And then Larry's flashback is done. And now
that we feel great sympathy for Flex.
Yeah.
Let's cut back to Flex now, right?
Right. And so he is watching Sacred Hearts on a laptop with Cliff. And it's the episode where Cliff was on.
Yes. Cliff is like, I think he's enjoying watching himself with this guy who loves the show so much. But also, I feel like because he doesn't have his sense of taste, he was like, you want some more syrup, buddy? You want some more syrup?
Yeah.
And as someone who has watched a mukbang or two, like, he's getting pleasure out of watching him eat and pleasure of him enjoying a thing that he was in. He's like, there was talk of a daytime Emmy for me.
Yeah. Well, and like, that's something Cliff, I think, brought up when they had first mentioned the soap opera. I was like, oh, I was on that show. There was talk of a daytime Emmy.
Yeah.
And then Larry comes in and says, we got to find his wife, Dolly.
Well, this is before or after Jane takes Cliff aside and is like, let's burn him with this torch.
Before Larry comes in, Jane's like, okay, we got to burn him with the torch.
And then Cliff, in a surprising act of empathy, is like, hey, I saw things inside your head in some part. I don't remember.
Yeah, Cliff's really surprised by this because of the things that he saw in Jane's head. Because in an earlier episode, Jane kind of gets stuck in her own head and Cliff goes in to try and help her.
But her bent is you can't force somebody to do something that they're not ready to do. And she, in this moment, to get Chief, is like, let's force him to do something he's not ready to do. And he's like, I don't think this is what you would want if you were in the right headspace. And I saw where you were because I was in your headspace. And I know you're not ready to talk about that, but when you are, I'm here. And I'm like, Cliff.
Yeah, what? But
that's surprisingly good.
Okay, but like, do we remember what he was saying at the beginning of this episode? Like, hey, Jane, bring out Flit so she can teleport us all out.
Yeah, but that's not forcing Flit to do it. Like, that's
no,
like...
he was telling Jane to force Flit to do it.
Well, no, I think, well, I don't know if that's the feeling I get. I feel like Jane's alters come out when the exact moment they are needed, it happens, and only when that happens. Yeah. And because they didn't need to teleport right that second, Flit was not going to do it.
Right.
And commanding Flit to do it was the reason why she was saying no.
Right.
But I don't think there's anything wrong in asking somebody who has an ability to do that thing for you.
Okay.
It can be a little selfish.
Yeah.
I don't know if selfish is always wrong.
Okay.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But this is, it's surprising that he was the one in this moment to remind her of her humanity towards herself and how that should reflect her humanity towards someone else who is obviously f***ed up.
Right. Also, like, I like to think that the characters are contradictory on some level at some point in the show. And, like, that's like humanity. That's human nature.
Being a hypocrite?
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure.
So, and then Larry comes in and says, we got to find his wife. That's the only way that this is going to work.
Back and forth. Yeah. Flit shows up.
She's like, yeah, I can do that. Bye.
He pops back in. Hello, Dolly. That's what I call this scene.
Just knowing how it ends, I have an idea of what your next, what another note might be.
Well, no, Jen said this exact same thing when I said it. Like, you said it, but I already wrote it down. So I got it first.
Yeah. And so Flex and Dolly are reunited.
Well, she's the one who got him tricked into the ant farm. So she's still locked in it. She held up her elbow and she's like, look at my elbow, young man.
She was the one who got she has this device on her hand, her elbow. She's like, look at my elbow. And that's what, it's the same thing that the cat had when Flex got taken, but it's not a cat. It's a thing on the elbow.
And then she laughs at her elbow and he's like, oh, that laugh. Yeah. And I love that laugh. And she like looks up and she's like, oh, that smile. It's always your greatest, Flex. And he's, you're the light of my world. And then they hug and they embrace and somebody, which one of them wants to interrupt them? And Jane is like, give them a minute.
Yeah.
Which is cute. And then
they hold and they embrace. And then what happens to Dolly?
Happily ever after. No?
She gets her Thanos snapped.
She gets full on dusted because she remembers the love of her life. And they were like, nope, we're going to make the Bureau of Normalcy is like one step ahead. And
she said, as she's dusting away a la freaking Spider-Man, right?
I don't feel good.
Right? She's like, they told me if I ever tried to look for you, this would happen. As like beeping goes off in the background, I'm like, okay, thanks.
So at this point in your notes, does it say goodbye, Dolly?
No. I just said she got snapped like Thanos. Okay. But then what happens is the rage flex.
Yes. He like flexes so hard, but he still shows a level of control because he doesn't break the house structure itself.
Yeah. He's just like every light bulb in this room.
Which are going to be easy to change.
I mean, if the bulb
is going to be a
you have to get like a potato in there and like unscrew it. It's a whole thing.
But it's going to be a lot easier than if he destroyed the entire mansion.
That's true. And considering like later on, Rita's like, get blood on that carpet and I'm going to kill you. Like, having to replace every light bulb seems like a bit more of a pain than cleaning a spot off the carpet.
Right.
Whatever.
So have either of you heard of a trope called barrier gaze?
Okay. How do you spell that? Can I have the spelling, please?
It's the word bury, like as in you're burying a dead body. And then gaze, as in G-A-Y-E-S.
Oh, okay.
So it's like where you have a gay couple and they're canonically gay in the show, and then one of them dies.
Oh, yes. The habit, like the, oh, yeah. It's what Schitt's Creek was really good about not doing, is that like you have this trope where like if there's a gay person, they have to be, their life has to be threatened just because they're gay.
Mm-hmm.
And, which only like reiterates. That whole like gay panic defense,
right? Or like gay people can't actually be happy because everything ends in tragedy.
And we are at this point, I think, in the turning of our culture where the like if a if a younger person, I would say, or any person, we are at a point where if somebody decides to identify to their friends and family or to anyone, if they decide to walk out into the street just holding a flag and are like, hey, I'm gay, like, you don't have to celebrate it. You know, that's just a thing you know about them now, right? But, like, maybe celebrate it a little bit. Like, kids I know now don't suffer the same. I mean, they have a greater access to community. Maybe in their own personal life, it's difficult. Life is hard. I don't know the experience that they have, but I know that they find community easier now than the kids when I was younger who would come out. And then it was like a whole hush-hush thing. And then we talked about it a little bit and behind closed doors, behind hands. And then it was like, it was, you came out in stages to certain people. Maybe you still do that, but like it's not. And what's going to happen when the wrong person finds out?
Right. And you could argue that Doom Patrol kind of does that between Larry's relationship with him and his like co-pilot. But like they're broken up at that point. And like there's more, it's more like a catharsis for Larry to kind of like recognize that here was this man that he had genuine feelings for.
He could have been with, he but could then have been had with. This whole life without him.
Right.
But he got to have a whole life.
Right.
And that I think is different.
That being said, Doom Patrol buries their straights, and I am here for it.
This is a super hetero couple, and you're like, that bitch.
See? See what you get for being straight?
Okay, I am super naughty for doing the Professor Chang thing, where like Jen and I will be talking, and Jen will say something, and I'll be like, gay. But like between us, like behind closed doors, and I would never do it to someone else. Like, and I'm kind of sorry sometimes when I do it to you, but like, but I know you know my heart and I'm not really doing it. You know, like you.
We tell each other to shut up all the time.
Like all the time, but never when we're actually mad.
Right.
So like, I'll say something super, like you'll be like, I love you, honey. And I'm like, you love a girl? Gay. Like, it's funny between us. Right. But like, I'd love.
You would never do it to a stranger. You would only do it to your spouse who you've known for 20 years.
Who gets the reference right off.
Gets the reference. And it's always, it's never in a derogatory manner when you're mad.
Yeah.
It's not something that's meant to put her down. It's meant as a joke. And both people participating in the joke understand the joke.
Yes. And we're willing participants. If Jen for a second said that that was inappropriate, I would be like, noted, done. Right. But I will say, as someone who has classically identified as a cishet female, if somebody was like, ew, hetero, I would be behind that 100%.
So, you know, the show Our Flag Means Death on HBO Max. You should totally check it out because it's great.
Yeah.
There are compilations on YouTube where, you know, they'll have like, you know, so-and-so being gay for, you know, 5 minutes straight.
Yes.
With Our Flag Means Death. They'll say like Steed and Ed being straight for 5 minutes gay.
Fantastic.
That's great.
Ew, hetero, but when they bury their straights and I'm here for it. I like that. If we ever get popular, we'll make that a bumper sticker. You know what? We've had so much good drama and it's such a high, intense emotional moment. You know what we need?
We need to go and see Vic and his dad.
More
and
daddy drama.
More daddy drama. At this point, Rita is talking to Vic about like how she doesn't like bullies and she doesn't think that, you know, they should be afraid of Mr. Nobody because they've had time to grow. The first time they met and interacted with Mr. Nobody was at the beginning of the season. And when they did that, they were kind of like torn down by everything that, you know, made them that, you know, they did wrong. And it was like fault. And it was enough to go ahead and be like, I don't want to deal with this guy. He's, you know, too powerful or too.
But like as she turns to go. Right.
Well, no, this is before she turns to go. She's still trying to convince Vic. And like this to me.
But she's already left the old guy.
Because she's back in the room with Vic and his dad, and she's convinces Vic to turn Grid back on so they can go ahead and locate the guy who was hunting for Niles. And when that scene is done, she turns around and she walks out through. It's the same shot with the baby carriage with the two, you know, with the two murals of the nurses. But instead of the baby carriage being there, it's Rita and she's walking through it like in a symbolizing her like willingness to kind of let go of the fact that she did something wrong and she's moving forward with her life.
And that's very important. But do we cut back to the old guy now?
As she's walking away, we see the old guy come into view. And what happens?
all my notes says, nobody was the guy.
Yeah. Basically, the old guy was Mr. Nobody. And he's just like, all, oh, good for you. And it feels like the episode's going to end.
But then, but then it cuts back to the mansion and Mr. Nobody's narrating and he goes, oh, God, there's more. I do that all the time. I'll be like, oh, this is a great moment. They should end this. And then it'll cut and I'll be like, me. Not that I want a thing that I enjoy to end, but when I think there's a good beat, I don't understand necessarily why there's always like another two or three beats left. You know what I mean?
Right.
So, I mean, it's why Jen has to check how much is left on an episode or a movie like frequently. I'm like, how much is left of this? Not because I'm not enjoying it, but I'm like, this part should have ended already.
Yeah.
But I stan Mr. Nobody on this.
Right.
Yeah. Negative spirit. Dang.
So negative spirit is out of Larry and he's like, Larry's coughing up blood. And he's like, you could tell he's like dying. And he's like, no, guy, you go and you get back home. I've lived my life. And Larry's pretty content with dying at this point.
Yeah.
But the negative spirit leaves the mansion. Cliff's all like, bastard. And then we see the negative spirit outside the mansion. He's like ready to make the leave. And then he comes back.
Yeah. He does a slow blink. And if he breathed, I'm sure he'd be like,
Also, negative spirit is probably non-binary. So
yeah, we don't know.
We don't know. I should just stick with they. Anyways, not the point.
I don't know.
Right.
Masculine to masculine. I mean, do you really think? Can I say something uncouth? Because I've talked about how like I would only say things in front of you.
And okay.
Do you think Larry would let a non-male spirit inhabit his body?
Willingly? I mean, if throughout the entire show, he's been very unwilling. And in season two, we kind of find like he's been kind of unwilling to be this. And maybe he didn't have to like be as deformed as he is.
It was a gay joke.
Oh.
not a good one. Not a clear cut one. And I apologize.
I'm just over anyways. Not the point. But negative spirit comes back, gets back into Larry's body and they're together again. And then Rita comes in and she says, if you get blood on the carpet, I'm going to kill you.
I'm glad you're alive.
Yeah.
But if you get blood on that carpet, I'll kill you.
Yes. And the team is back together.
Ready to take on the world. Except let's cut to some white space.
Oh, yeah. So Mr. Nobody is like watching the episode and he's like, finally, a superhero team I can get behind.
He's wearing a Doom Patrol hat, a Doom Patrol jersey. He's drinking out of a Doom Patrol cup.
He has a Doom Patrol blanket on him.
Yes. And he stands up and he's got the stupidest, like, what kind of, they're the kind of pants like you'd ride on, a horse.
Yeah.
He's got like, they're not chaps, but they're like they're wide at the thigh.
Yeah.
Which I don't understand.
Like Oompa Loompas.
Yeah, a little bit, except they're obviously riding pants of some kind. That I don't understand. I've never been a jockey. But he walks over, he walks over to the poster and he like punches out Vic's face.
Right, because Vic has said like, you can find Niles, but you're going to have to do it without me, which is a point that I didn't bring up.
Well, he reinstates Jarvis.
Yeah, Grid.
Grid.
Yeah, and so Mr. Nobody, you know, punches out his face like, the team's back together. And now we can have a superhero show with the superhero show.
Yes. And now we're ready for the supervillain. And the villain is me. Ah! And he like super intenses into the camera while the poster, it's a huge poster, like goes up in flames behind him. And it's like, he doesn't laugh, but I want him to be like, ma. Yeah. But he does it with his eyes. And that's the magic of Alan Tudyk.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that's the end of the episode, but it's not the end of the podcast because we got another episode and we're going right into it. This is the penultimate patrol. This is the second to last episode. That's why they call it the penultimate.
Of the first season?
Of the first season.
Thank you, Applauder. You've joined us for our first of two episode walkthroughs of DC Comics' Doom Patrol on HBO Max. We still have one more episode to walk you through, penultimate patrol. And can't wait to reveal our shocked and applaudable moments with you. Looking for more super comic book discussions? Good Day to Podcast, hosted by Gardner, Duncan, and Taryn, recently reviewed Doctor Strange and the Multiverse of Madness. And Cult Film Companion Podcast, the home of movies off, under, and ahead of the cinematic radar, recently reviewed Howard the Duck. You can check out links to these shows in this release's description. Hey, this is your audio engineer and, honest to goodness, someone who auditioned as Peter Parker for the first Sam Raimi Spider-Man film, Jen. Now that we're two-thirds of the way through our first review of a serialized show, do you have any thoughts? If you've never seen Doom Patrol, Was our introduction last week strong enough for you to understand the show? You can send your feedback or questions to shockedandapplaud@gmail.com. We'll be back next week to discuss our second episode selection of this quirky streaming comic book adaptation. From Shocked and Applaud, thank you for patroning the peculiar.